So good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone. Once again, thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Jessica Salzwedel, and I do work at AVA. You are joining us on the second installment of the curriculum webinar series. For those that have attended in the past, the curriculum webinar series is, for the curriculum in general, is a real labor of love and a collaboration between several organizations, in particular the Martin Villainy Collaboratory. And so today we're going to be continuing on our road to Durban, sort of what information is needed, and talking about stakeholder engagement. And for those that once again are just joining, you are joining in meet mode because we are actually recording this for future use. So we can get started. So here we go. So today we're going to just talk a little bit about and describe some of the lessons learned from HIV prevention research. I think this is a real wealth of knowledge that we can draw from. We're going to describe what stakeholder engagement is. I think we're used to hearing it as community engagement, so we'll talk a little bit about what it means to be a stakeholder and what's involved in that. And then why engagement is important for HIV cure research. You know, there's a lot happening in the field, and so why bring in stakeholders at such an early phase when there aren't that many trials or large-scale clinical trials happening? So why now? Once again, we encourage throughout the session to ask questions, use your chat function. This hopefully will be quite the interactive presentation, and so we do encourage you to really engage along. So first question, and this is really to all of you, is how can we define stakeholder? So what is a stakeholder in research? And if you're online, you can go ahead and use your chat function. And if you're just on audio, if you hit *7, you can unmute your line and go ahead and participate.
Can you repeat the question, please?
So the question, Ebony, is how can we define stakeholder?
Well, I think some of the limitations around HIV interventions is that we have a very narrow lens of who our stakeholders are, which I think lends its way to stigma or isolated approaches that are just targeting key populations in a global lens or in a U.S. context. Sex workers and men who have sex with men. And so I think that, you know, a very narrow definition of stakeholder has been served more to the demise of HIV interventions because they look at behaviors and they follow stereotypes and, of course, epidemiological trends. But I think if we operate in a bigger contextualization of stakeholder, we can not only reach people with treatment who need treatment, but we can get people engaged in the conversation who are uninfected or who we build a better core base of support system, a better base of caregivers. So I think that we should have a very broad lens around stakeholder because people we know who sometimes don't meet the list still have some touch point of HIV engagement.
Great. So that's a really comprehensive definition of stakeholder, and I love it. And I see that there's one more that has come in on the chat function, which is that community members who hold an intense interest in HIV cure research and wish to build bridges between researchers and community as the field advances forward. So both of those have two really great pieces. One is the idea that Ebony was talking about, is that stakeholders can be limited when we define them by characteristics, right? When we talk about the LGBT community, or we talk about perhaps young women, we're limiting our focus. So stakeholders might be limited by potential participants. And then there's also, which is a great definition that came in through the chat, that it's community members who are interested. So stakeholders are people who self-identify as those who are interested in the research process. Both are right. And I think that, and we'll talk about both throughout the presentation in relation to cure. But so there's sort of these broad definitions, as Ebony so beautifully said, we should be thinking broader. And while we can think about stakeholders on a global scale, right? They can be our funders, the people who create rules, international foundations like GATE. National stakeholders, the people at the country level, our IRBs or our ministries of health that are creating protections and rules around research. They might be broad. And so broad in and of itself is kind of a confusing term, but these are these individuals who are media or maybe medical professionals that aren't HIV care providers, but are OBGYNs, are you know, ENTs, the other individuals in our sphere that we see. They could be our local NGOs, so large organizations, or our local policymakers, maybe our mayor or our governor, if you are a New Yorker, right? Then you may think of community. This is, I think, perhaps what we often think about when we think about engagement. These are the people we reach. The CBOs are community-based organizations. Participant families in CURE, this is probably going to be the one of the stakeholders that are really interesting, like the participant partner. You know, how do they play a role in the research process? What is their perspective there? Peers, trial staff. This is, to me, a really key piece because it's, you know, when we think about engagement, it's not just from the research center out. It's also within. The people who work at a trial site are also stakeholders and should be included in this engagement process about what's working and what's not. Our local health providers, community advisory boards, and traditional leaders. And then here we kind of bring it back and we see this whole picture, which is, you know, the entire diagram. So we're trying to reach everybody, but at the center of this is really the trial participant and the potential user. And when we think about HIV cure, we are thinking about a potential user, a person living with HIV. How does this research process, and research is a process, right, impact this potential user? And then how do all the other stakeholder groups play together to make this research process whole? So moving through, I have another question. So one of the questions that came up, which is where do we place everyone else who could become infected or who are infected? This is such a great question. So for those individuals that are HIV negative but maybe high risk, well, you know, I think on this diagram, we may place them as community stakeholders at first, people concerned or interested in the research process, but eventually or potentially they may become a potential user. So another question for all of you, how do we define community? This is one of my favorite questions. What is the definition of community? And once again, please use your chat function, or you can go ahead and press *7 to unmute your line. So we see that, yeah, community is it's a group of people galvanized around a common goal. Great. Community is fluid. Community are defined by a location. Great. So all of these answers are absolutely right, which is, you know, these are two quotes. The first is by Kate McQueen, who is a researcher based in North Carolina at FHI 360. And I really like it because it does incorporate this, right? It's a group of people with diverse characteristics who are linked by social ties, share common perspectives, engage in joint action in a geographic location or setting. The people who are like-minded and live near each other, right? But a community also, and this is, I think, speaks really well to Ebony's point, that community is about who is included and who is excluded. And when we think about stakeholders, and we think we often link it to communities. And so we think about who is included in that definition, right? The LGBT community, MSM community. And we do research and we work with this community. And so we link that to stakeholders. But community is something that is self-defined. And we know this because in the Denver Principles, people living with HIV demanded a place at the table. And they created a community for themselves and a population as a stakeholder, right? They said, we want a place at the table. And from that, in 1983, came the Denver Principles, which is really the first real way that community was involved in the HIV research process. And we know that this is about treatment. So this is really the first time, right, this is really the first place we see in the HIV field that people living with HIV carve themselves out as a community, carve themselves out as a stakeholder, and demanded engagement. So where does engagement fit? I think when we think about research and protections, it's often from the top down or from the research site out to that center sphere, that trial participant. And we look here on this sort of puzzle piece, game board. The WHO, CIOMS, UNAIDS, they all create protections to help guide research sites out into the world. Protections, do's and don'ts, ethical do's and don'ts for the way research should be conducted. Good clinical practice, which we'll talk about as well, is from the research site out. How does the research team work with, or how do they act around a trial participant? Human rights considerations, right? All of these other three pieces in blue focus around the trial participant and the way research sites should act around and toward and about a trial participant. But that little pink puzzle piece in the right-hand corner, stakeholder engagement, that's really about that's about everybody else. That's how the other pieces kind of fit in. This is the broader engagement. And here, throughout this presentation, we'll be talking about good participatory practice, which are a set of guidelines created by UNAIDS and ABAC to help guide and to create a set of principles around this type of engagement, this broad engagement. So before we even get into sort of what this means for CURE, I think as we step back, here we're going to see GCP is not GPP, right? Good participatory practice. And like I said, it's really the investigator to the trial participant. And good participatory practice brings this other element, all of these other stakeholders, which are going to be your advocacy groups, the partners of potential participants, local health leaders, religious leaders that can kind of come in and weigh in. And so sort of the next question that follows is, why do we engage beyond the participant? And how many of you know about the PrEP controversy? Okay, so we're getting a few yeses in the chat function. So just a brief overview, why do we engage beyond the participant? So as some of you may know, some of you do know, in the early 2000s, 2003, 2004, 2005, there were these PrEP trials that were going on in sex workers in Cameroon and Nigeria, these trials went through a standard engagement process. And by that, I mean they went through an IRB. They got, you know, notes from a community advisory board. And the trials went through. And as they were being conducted, an advocacy organization for sex workers saw that the trials were exploiting the participants, were exploiting the female sex workers. And this photo, which is sort of timely as we approach Durban, right, it's from an international AIDS conference, an IAS conference. And they actually got the advocates got the trials to shut down. So in 2005, Cameroon and Nigeria's trials were discontinued. In 2004, Cambodia decided not to initiate a trial. And this all comes from the fact that they weren't thinking broadly, right, this idea of broad participation. And the reason why this is interesting and why how we might think about it for CURE is we are no longer in sort of a siloed atmosphere. CURE is broad and it's global, and we need to think about all of the participants. So, once again, a question for all of you. What principles make good engagement? So what do we want to see? How do we know good engagement when we see it? What are the principles we look for? Once again, you can either use your chat function or you can hit *7 to unmute your line. So we look for inclusiveness. Oh, go ahead, Ebony.
No, I think a piece of a good engagement is when it's a dialogue. I think that, you know, even though we have GPP, we do still see studies where participation is not as genuine as it could be. If you look at the last ring trials, you know, they had very low adherence with something that's, you know, useful 30 days at a time. But in talking with young women post the study, they said, well, where do you put it when you're on your menstrual cycle? Where do you have a case that you carry it in? Well, what do you do in the instance of this? So I think that it's really important that we can see good participatory practice in action where it's not just a kind of information that's being given and there's no barometer of whether it's being digested. I think the participatory practice is when, you know, study sites are recruiting, engaging, but also participants are really able to ask questions. Participants are able to find out what the participation means in a sense of the study outcomes, but what it means really directly for them, and also the things that it takes to maintain their participation within the context of their regular daily lives. I think, you know, studies have to be incentivized, of course, because that's real purpose. And sometimes it's potentially physical impact, which may or may not be positive. But I think that we still have a ways to work to see true actualization of good participatory practice when we're looking at studies and we still see that people are not adherent, and maybe not because they don't want to be, but because they really don't understand the full nuances of what's expected of them, what's required. And then also if there's not an environment where people can do truth-telling. Your doctor's appointment doesn't work if you can't do truth-telling, and they say patients fail regimens, but a lot of times regimens may not have been really set up in a way that works for that person's life or for their diet. And I think the same thing happens in studies. You know, there are efforts being made, and these guidelines, I participated heavily when they were created. I think it's great, but I think we still have work to do. I think people still are not always at a place where they understand what their participation means, where they know how to maintain their participation, and where they can communicate before the end of the study if something about their participation isn't working right or is uncertain. Because I think it would really change the kind of results we see. It's hard sometimes to even have a real grasp on efficacy when it's really great in one group and not really great in the other group. And sometimes I think that communication piece and that level of being honest is really missing. So I think we have made some strides, but we still have a ways to go with that.
Great. That's such a wonderful answer, and I think it sums up a lot of what's coming in on the chat, which is inclusiveness, trust, mutual respect, literacy and capacity. And here's sort of this, once again, from the good participatory practices, a lot that was mentioned: respect, mutual understanding, integrity, transparency. And just to focus on transparency, you know, this is a lot of what Ebony just once again beautifully said. How do we know that there can be truth-telling, that participants really know how to participate, you know, what it means to participate? Truth trials are going to be, they're different than prevention. They're different than treatment. You know, they're really pushing limits and trying to answer a question that has never been answered before. And so what does that mean? There's a lot of unknowns. And how can we be as transparent as possible? I like to focus on community stakeholder autonomy because I do feel like, you know, one of the how do you be autonomous if you are you don't have an understanding or a full understanding of what participation means? How do you hold yourself accountable if you're not entirely sure of what's going on in the protocol? And if you don't feel like you can come to your healthcare provider. So really, I think there's the other pieces are important, and they really line up in this idea of community stakeholder autonomy. So there's also, you know, how do we engage? There's lots of mechanisms. TABs, as I mentioned, are quite popular. They're part of HIV research, TB research. Call-in radio shows may be replaced now if you think about it through things like social media, which we'll talk about. But the most informal, the stakeholder meeting at the end, stakeholders, as we've kind of covered, right, are a very broad category. So if you are at a bar talking about PrEP or you're talking about the latest headlines of cure, maybe that's an informal way to talk about research and to have these stakeholder meetings and get input and feedback. And bring that to CABS or bring that to your community educators. So there are really informal ways as well and to have this type of engagement and to have engagement be continuous. So why is it important? And this is really when we think about HIV cure rate, there's the landscape of engagement. A person has received their HIV positive diagnosis, and that's not it. You know, it's not over from there. And when we think about it in relationship to trials, you've received your diagnosis, do you have access to treatment? And when we think about it in research terms, are you close to a salvage regimen? If I go on this trial that has a treatment interruption, is there going to be access to care for me if something was to go wrong? If there's a treatment interruption, and I rebound, is there an exposure to criminalization? What about my personal health? What is this going to do to the other aspects of my life? If a person is on Stribal and is taking one pill a day, what about the other aspects of their personal health that may be compromised or may be enhanced? What about the stigma? Am I fully out? What happens? If I announce myself to be a person living with HIV, is there an exposure to violence, potentially? And on top of all that, right, there's another layer that comes into this. When we think about clinical trials, if people are walking into a research site, are they experiencing homophobia? What about racial stigma? Or do they have other things going on in their life, like housing security? Do they not know where they're going to sleep tonight? And is that really their main priority when they are thinking about research? Research is not a top priority for them. So when we think about engagement, there's really a whole landscape of pieces that need to be addressed. Then another reason why engagement is important, you know, research, I call it fast media, right? But it's this idea that headlines aren't always accurate. There's the potential to spread rumors. There's the potential to erode trust. And in this little box is a real headline that was from April in the Telegraph. Cure for HIV possible within 3 years as scientists snip virus from cells. 3 years, right? So this is something, obviously, it's an exaggerated headline, but it can cause friction, right? So in by fast media, I don't just mean social media. I mean if you're sitting on CNN and you see the news screens roll by or you read blogs, it's all kind of information comes at us very quickly, and it may not always be accurate. So why is engagement important? Well, because, you know, it's not just the researcher telling communities what's happening. There's also, you know, different sources that are presenting information. Once again, so this is just a lesson learned from prevention. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with the MVP 301 trial. It's a vaginal microbicide. It was conducted in Zambia, Uganda, and South Africa. And in December of 2009, the announcement came down that the results were flat. So they weren't positive, and they didn't harm anybody. They weren't effective, right? The results were flat. The trial sites in Zambia had a communication plan. However, the communication plan to tell communities about the results. However, a Zambian blogger who was actually based in the UK, so was not living in Zambia at the time, he published false information on his blog. And the information was picked up, and it he published it on a Friday. The information was picked up, and there was sort of a rumor storm that kind of happened. And once it was picked up by the local Zambian media, and this caused a real distrust. A rift between the community and the research site and this is around microbicide trials. And this has led, you know, years later after this incident, researchers had a challenging time securing approval from the Zambian government to do microbicide research. So here we see an instance, and this is obviously quite an extreme case, right? But here we see an instance of a social media, a blogger post that has kind of gone viral. And I know many of you on the call are educators, as I can see. I'm sure you all have a story or a history where there was something about where social media or a blogger or whatever or a headline has really taken off or taken root in your community. And I think, you know, based on what we saw from that last headline, you know, HIV cured happening in 3 years, well, if we fast forward to 2019 and there's no cure, does that cause mistrust? So there's all these things, I think, when we think about engagement around cure, why do we need to do it?
Well, I think one thing that we've started posturing ourselves into slogans, you know, we can end AIDS, you know, 20 by 20, 30 by 30, you know, 15,000 by 15,000, and I think that we don't focus on the health literacy component of really making sure that we unpack, you know, what it entails, what it means. I think when we look at the, Timothy, the German patient, the Holland patient. I can't
mm-hmm.
think of
Timothy Brown.
Yeah, Timothy Brown. I mean, if we look at his case, you know, I think when people heard about that, they thought, oh, you know, we didn't unpack whether it was a functional cure, whether it was, you know, a lifelong cure. And I think people had a lot of misinformation about all that it entailed, that this was really, you know, can I have a cup of coffee? An act of desperation.
So I think that's actually a really great point. And so I would love to raise that with everybody. Do others feel like they have that experience where there's a lot of slogan and rhetoric about, you know, the end or end AIDS or the cure. Do people feel as though that's a misconception, or do they have experiences with misconception in their communities? Once again, you can either type that into the chat function or you can hit *7 and share that. Well, you can feel free to chime in, but just to kind of keep it going, once again, there's a language around cure. And for those of us who are, you know, prevention and treatment advocates, cures is really a whole new language. It just came in, and I've actually heard this before myself, is the general misconception, at least in Sacramento, is that Magic Johnson is cured. And an AIDS-free generation is really a lofty promise. So when we say AIDS-free, does that even include cure? So I think that there's a lot out there that we're trying to kind of deal with in our community. So when I say cure is a new language, here's a sample protocol. And you'll notice the little icon on the left, the green circle with a few pills in it. And this is when you start to get a feel for the curriculum. This represents early art. And I know this to be an early art-related protocol because of the language. It started on ARTS. You start on a treatment during an acute HIV infection, CBIG stage 1 to CBIG stage 3. CBIG stages are just a way to categorize how many days post-infection you are tested and in relationship to treatment. And CBIG stage 1 is post-infection, right? So CBIG stage 1 is 14 days post-infection. So quite early, right, before antibodies form. So very, very soon after infection, some of these protocols start. Some other really new language, right, is HIV reservoirs. And when I say new language, it's not just new language for advocates, right? It's new language for the person doing the intake form. It's new language, perhaps, for the researcher at the clinic site. It's new language for the community. When we talk about cure, it's a new language. And as Ebony said, there's a real literacy piece that needs to come into that. And so this is part of the reasons why we engage. There's a really great comment that came in, which is that AIDS-free is actually quite offensive to those people who are living with HIV. It implies they've left this world. This person says that it should no longer be used. This idea that AIDS-free doesn't include a cure. AIDS-free is just for those individuals that are negative to stay negative, to remain negative. So AIDS engagement in HIV cure research, right? So this is really sort of the new, we've kind of talked a lot about, well, what does it mean and why do we need to engage? Well, how can we do that? Well, one way is through formative research. This is a lot of what I think has been said, which is just that you need to know your communities. You need to walk in. Once again, there's a lot of educators on the line. So how do we know what we're walking into? Is there a comment?
Okay. And if I could get this call.
I think one thing is that we can't make presumptions about what communities do or don't know. Okay. And I think that, you know, I didn't get to really kind of complete my comment the last time. I apologize. But in thinking about, you know, AIDS-free generation, that could encompass cure. I know when Michelle Sidibe and UNAIDS set it out, it wasn't really coming from a cure lens. But I think one thing about it that I saw was that there was a lot of confusion. A lot of African governments came to the table when, you know, AIDS-free generation was first kind of, you know, taking a tagline and said, people living with HIV have a really hard time with that language. That sounds like what happened in Cuba. That sounds like eradication. That sounds like, you know, no more investments in people who are already living with HIV and may already have an AIDS diagnosis. So I think part of it is about the framing. Part of it is about the health literacy. It's about showing people the potential benefits. You know, and not only people in HIV, but people who are still working outside of HIV who feel like there's this overinvestment in HIV, overinvestment in AIDS research, that there's still this HIV exceptionalism, because I think when we're talking about it, one is acceptability, you know, when cure is available, but another thing is not only acceptability, it's also appetite. And appetite will drive funding, and appetite will also drive political momentum. and decisions that will actually lead to funding research for cure and actually prioritizing, you know, cure in the wake of Alzheimer's and cancer and other things that are still pervasive and need attention. But this just one other component of that is thinking about the Berlin patient, which we know had a stem cell transplant and a lot of very complicated processes, but also thinking about the Mississippi baby. So you're sitting at home in your kitchen and you hear baby cured, bad mother, out of treatment, re-engaged, cured. And then you hear Mississippi baby not cured. And then 2 years later you hear cure research is coming and you're confused. So I think it's also about how we work with the media, but how we are intentional about even when there are missteps, that we do retractions and we do corrections and we make it accessible for people who are not living and breathing HIV or who are not working in research, that we say, okay, this is what did happen, this is the piece where the breakdown happened, this is what we learned, and this is how we're going to go forward. So even if it doesn't come back till 2 or 3 years later, people have an expectation that something good came out of that and that we're going to build on it. If you say it worked, it didn't work, people are like, I don't trust it. But I think we don't have to leave them at that endpoint. We can do the work in between. I think there's a lot of work to be done before cure actually is available in whichever format or formulation. So,
great. No, I mean, that's such a wonderful segue into what we're going to be talking about. You know, it's true. I think that there's I love that you use the phrase appetite for HIV cure research. You know, where are we in the world? There are a lot of competing priorities, funding and other diseases. And I think that what is the appetite for research? And that's another layer of what we have to kind of engage with, when we do engagement with communities. And part of that is figuring out what, you know, when we think about formative research, what we're walking into. What are the local power dynamics, local perceptions? What do they know? You know, what kind of messages are they hearing? Is it AIDS-free generation? Is it towards an HIV cure? Or is the message really focused on test and treat? You know, what's happening? What is the local messages? And to just give you kind of two groups that are working on that now, Search HIV, which is a group out of UNC Chapel Hill, they're working globally in Cape Town, Guangzhou, China, and also locally in Chapel Hill to figure out, do this kind of formative work. What do people think about cure? How do people react? What are some of the messages that can be used in these settings? And then APSEC in France as well. This is funded by Sedexion, and this is a group that's doing some of the work around perception work. What do people think, potential participants? Others on the line I know are doing some of this work as well. So this is kind of happening, this formative work. You know, a stakeholder engagement plan, in particular, a communication plan. How do we talk to people about HIV cure research? How do we talk to them about an idea? You know, there are five symbols on the side, four of which really represent scientific research. How do we talk to them about latency reversing agents or taking kill as a strategy, especially when it's so militaristic? How do we talk about gene therapy, immune modulators? These are complex scientific topics. And how do we engage on a cure when we don't know what a cure might look like? Or as Ebony said, you know, how do we talk about a functional cure which has the potential to come back, right, remission? And how do we engage with media to report things appropriately and really build trust and maintain trust with community? And then also an education plan. And how do we educate people in the new language? There are so many new things that are also emerging, right, all of the time in cure. Every time there's a new theory, right, kick and kill, block and lock, they all come out, and then you have to educate around terms or around concepts or around strategies. So how do we educate around something that's evolving and new? The informed consent process, you'll see, once again, the little, this is green, the scales. This is ethics. engagement is ethical, right? It's important for participants to be involved. Nothing about us without us, right? But really to engage everybody in this conversation. And to inform consent, it is a process. I think the bullet I'd like to just draw your attention to is the bottom bullet, which is partner consent process. What is that in HIV cure research? Is there a partner consent process? And if there is one, how, that's something we've never really done before, right? The partner may become exposed to it. What's the obligation of researchers? Later in this series, in the week of June 29th, we'll actually be having an ethics webinar where we'll be really going into this, deep diving with advocates around these questions. But this just shows you the bottom timeline of what an informed consent process may look like. We had another great just point, once again, kind of going back to this AIDS-free generation. You know, our planet achieved a smallpox-free planet by gradually getting everyone to work towards a smallpox-free planet. So surely we all wish to work towards an AIDS-free planet. And I think perhaps, you know, once again, when we think about these messaging of cure, what does this cure mean? Is it eradication? Is it remission? And how do we become free? Is it on an individual level? Or are we AIDS-free as a population level, on a planet level? And I think those have different dynamics, all of which when we think about engagement, we have to think about, right, how do we communicate this very evolving concept and in this background in this framework of fast media and the person's, an individual's landscape, right? So all of that needs to be taken into consideration. Access to HIV care, I mentioned this, you know, briefly, and I think it's just an important when we think through what's important for engagement in HIV cure, access to HIV care. What happens if my regimen fails and I need to go on a new therapy? Are those drugs available where I live? How do I get access to them? And partner disclosure. Perhaps I'm not in a monogamous relationship and I would like to be on a trial that involves treatment interruption. How do I disclose that status and this research to my partner? Are there tools to help me understand? What groups as researchers can you talk to? And what, as an advocate, what's my role in making sure access to care is available, right? So there are kind of two sides to these coins. HIV care and treatment guidelines vary by country. So when we think about a trial that's being rolled out, and I think we can look once again to prevention and the VRC01 broadly neutralizing antibody trial and look to see what happens if PrEP isn't available in every country. How do the guidelines change? And I think we can start to kind of anticipate this as we look at HIV cure trials in different settings. South Africa is very different than Uganda, and Uganda is very different than San Francisco. And how do we have access to care? San Francisco is very different than Chapel Hill, right, than North Carolina. So how do we account for the variety of access, both on a country level and then at a local level? And when we decide our trials, how do we account for those things? There's also policies on trial-related harm. Trial-related harm isn't just physical harm. There's certainly social harm that can happen, and I think that there are HIV cure-related harms that we haven't thought about. And I think we all think about the physical harms, right? What could happen if somebody's going in and even though they've been proven safe or they're showing safety, right? How do we know what happens when something is snipping a gene or when there's an FDA drug that's approved for a different disease that I would now take and that it could potentially lead to an HIV cure? So there are physical concerns, right? But then there are social harms. What happens to my family's hopes and expectations if I'm involved in a cure-related trial? Do they think I'm going to be cured? Does my partner hope? Is that a harm? Once again, the stigma. Employment. If I am the protocol that I showed, we'll just go back to it. Each little orange dot represents a follow-up, an RNA, an HIV RNA test, right? Every 3 days for 48 weeks. If you are doing that, if you're going in every 3 days, sometimes twice a week, does that impact your potential job prosperity, right? Does that impact your job? So there are those sorts of things, and perhaps difficult personal relationships. And then why is it important? You know, we talked about how and all these other aspects, so why? Well, research is happening. Research is happening. These are just some of the funders. This doesn't go into the list of clinical trials. It does not go into a list of countries. But TAG has a beautiful list. Richard Jeffrey at TAG curates it. It's 7 pages long. of current enrolling clinical trials involving humans, right? MHRP is working with the Thai Red Cross, and IMPACT is rolling out P11, an infant study, at all of their trial sites. The Martin Delaney Collaboratories in the upper left-hand side, there are currently 3, and with a new announcement hopefully coming soon about new trial sites or new collaboratories. The CHIRUB Network, funding by the NHS in the UK, CanCure, AMFAR has a program. So there's a lot of cure HIV trials happening already. So engagement is incredibly important. So sort of the conclusions before we get to any questions, some of the things that it's very clear is education and transparency are key goals. Stakeholder advisory mechanisms, how we interact can help achieve those, but these are clear goals for CURE. Critical that all stakeholders, including healthcare providers, media, partners are all involved in this process, that ministries of health are involved, so we can't just limit it to sort of the trial participant or potential user. And then we need to develop a comprehensive plan. It's not enough necessarily to go trial by trial, but we need to think about what is our overall goal, what is our overall messaging, and how does CURE fit into the landscape of prevention and treatment, and how do we talk about all of this in a way that's representative of sociocultural norms. So with that, in the last sort of 10 minutes, I just want to acknowledge everybody that participated or that helped inform this, in particular UCSF gave funding towards this through an MDC collaboratory grant, and the members of the Martin Delaney Collaboratory CAB have really been invaluable in contributing and putting this information together. With that, I just would like to ask if there are any questions. Once again, you can use your chat function or hit *7 to unmute your line. So any questions or final comments? Once again, hit *7 to unmute, or you can go ahead and ask it in the chat function. I see one question, which is how do I get involved? This is a great question. You know, one of the ways to get involved is really to look and see what CURE research is happening in and around where you live. And so you can either do that by going to clinicaltrials.gov and searching through some of the trials. We're looking at some of these funder sites that I mentioned earlier, AMFAR, MHRP, and seeing what's going on, ACTG, seeing if there are any CURE-related trials, get on a CAB, a community advisory board, or see what you can start following the media trends, what looks like it may be an exaggeration. Start following some of the, I love Gus Card. And there are other advocates who speak so eloquently about this. Just getting involved by voicing your opinion at town forums that the FDA has, or some of the eventual ethical forums that will happen. just getting involved in those very broad ways can be invaluable. Will AVAC conduct a stakeholder forum at Durban? Right now, there is no plan for a stakeholder forum that AVAC is going to conduct. But if you are going to Durban, the International AIDS Society is having an HIV cure community forum, which is on Saturday. Now I'm moving in the calendar. Saturday, July 16th. And it will be in the morning. And so if you're there, I encourage you to go and hear what's going on here, the latest and greatest of scientific updates, but also voice your opinion. There's going to be a great community panel there as well. Any final comments, concerns, questions? Okay. Well, with that, I just want to thank everybody, and I just want to also say stay tuned into our next webinar in the series is going to be early antiretroviral therapy and how that factors into HIV cure research, and it's going to be led by Dr. Jintana Anawarich from MHRP, from the Military HIV Research Program, and it will be on Thursday, June 23rd at 9 a.m. Eastern.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you all, and have a wonderful afternoon, evening, and morning. Great. Bye.